Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week, we take a tabletop mechanic and cage it within a tight, fenced-off area. My name is Sam Dunnewald, and my co-host today is Nova, a.k.a. Idle Cartoolery. Nova's back! She's an RPG critic and a blogger with at least one foot firmly in the Elf game and OSR-adjacent worlds. A few of her posts from last year are up for the Bloggies this year. Check out the Bloggies, a DIY fan awards show for the RPG blogosphere. And Nova is someone I talk to a lot about games and how they work. I like our conversations, and because Nova's got a foot in both the OSR world and the story games world, I thought she'd be a good fit for today's episode. Today, we are talking about Blades in the Dark and Duskfall's Lightning Barriers. In Blades in the Dark, you play as criminals in Duskfall, a haunted city where ghosts are such a problem that they built giant electric fences, like huge, humongous lightning barriers around the whole city to keep all the ghosts out. And these barriers are powered by demon blood as hunted by titanic whaling ships seeking leviathans. Isn't that sick as hell? There's already so much in just those first few sentences to get me started playing at the table with Blades in the Dark. This show in particular spends a lot of time talking about rules, and rules are super important. They can radically shape what you do at the table. But the fiction a game brings is just as important, even when it's completely disconnected from the rules. Duskfall's lightning barriers mean you can't just run away into the wilderness after you've committed some crimes, and that's just as important for ratcheting up the tension and consequences of being criminals in your campaign as the mechanics of like Devil's Bargains or Dice Pools or whatever else Blades in the Dark is using. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. You're now paying for me to hire fan favorite co-host Emma Costa to edit the show sometimes, and that really just means so much to me, and it really helps me make more of the show. So thank you so much for supporting the show on Patreon. And here today is Nova with Duskfall's Lightning Barriers from Blades in the Dark. Nova, welcome back to Dice Exploder.
Thank you very much for having me.
What are we talking about today? We're talking about Blades in the Dark, yeah?
We're talking about Blades in the Dark. We're talking specifically about the lightning barrier. Just to recap, Duskfall is a city in a world full of murderous ghosts, and there is a giant lightning barrier that is erected around the city to keep these ghosts out. That lightning barrier is powered by the blood of magical psychic whales, and so there are whaling ships that go out to collect their blood, and this powers the lightning barrier. And the fictional impact of this lightning barrier is that you as player characters never leave Duskfall. However, that is entirely an in-fiction rule there. Theoretically, you could break down the lightning barrier or exit the lightning barrier. That is something we'll talk about.
Yeah. Great. So the thing that we're talking about today is the lightning barriers. Is this a mechanic? I want to get to that question also. But to start with, I want to talk about the difference between I've been reading The Rule Book by Marcus Montola and Jaco Stenros, which is...
Yeah, that's an exceptional book, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And like the basic thesis, it's all about rules in games. And the basic thesis is there's five different kinds of rules. And they are formal rules, which are like what you think of when you think of game rules, right? It's like pass, go, and Monopoly, collect $200, right? There's internal rules, which are rules you set for yourself. So like maybe you're playing with your kid and you're like, okay, well, I'm going to like handicap myself without telling them so that it's a fairer game, right?
Yeah.
Social rules, which are like, what's a good social rule example?
Think of social rules as like gamemanship or like sportsmanship.
Yeah. Don't like cuss your friends out, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. Like, yeah.
Yeah. External regulation, which is like, you know, referees making calls, which is it's different. It's you know, interested in like the enforcement of these various rules. And then material rules, which are like laws of physics, right? And RPGs, I think, interact with this structure of rules really interestingly because there's also like levels of where does the rule exist in the fiction in a role-playing game. You've got formal rules really clearly, right? Like we have in Blades in the Dark, we've got the position and effect conversation. We've got the idea of the action role, yada, 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 all that stuff.
And that's really what we've more traditionally like discussed on Dice Exploder.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that in a second. But then you also have, there's this other article that I'll link to from Sam Sorensen talking about diegetic and hypodiegetic rules. So diegetic rules are stuff like when someone dies in the world of Blades in the Dark, their ghost leaves their body and like slowly goes crazy and starts eating people, right?
Yeah, so this is the physics of the role-playing game realm.
100%. Whereas the hypodiegetic rules are things like, okay, well, if you hide someone's body in your basement and the cops find out, they're going to come arrest you. And so it's like laws created by people in the fiction, right?
Yeah, ones that you can choose to follow or you can choose not to follow as player characters.
And the existence of these lightning barriers falls somewhere between those diegetic rules and hypodiegetic rules, I feel like.
So I would say that if they were a hypodiegetic rule, it would be more of a context of, I remember there was this movie, I can't remember the name of the movie. There was a movie where it was set in a village with a wall and no one was to leave the village. And that was kind of like the premise between this movie. It was an M. Night Shyamalan movie,
I think. It's called The Village.
The Village, there you go. I think that if Duskvol had a wall like that and it was taboo to leave the village, that would put it solidly in hypodiegetic rules.
Yeah.
But because that you physically are prevented from leaving this lightning barrier, and we'll probably get into this at a different stage, but like in the book of Blades in the Dark, I am pretty certain there are no ways to get outside in the book, yeah, included in the book of Blades in the Dark. And obviously this is a role-playing game. But you're kind of trapped, and that's the intent.
Yeah, there exist the Deathlands scavengers, who are like people, often like conscripts, who are like sent out into the Deathlands beyond the lightning barriers to ghost bust their way to like something salvageable to bring back home, you know, that kind of stuff.
And the whalers, obviously.
Obviously, yeah. All of this is to say, like, this, what a bunch of theory to just throw out there just to say, like, yes, this isn't a rule where you're rolling dice, right? Like, this is a piece of the fiction. And, like, I think kind of the thesis, the reason I wanted to do this episode in the first place is to talk about how much more important in a lot of ways that kind of quote-unquote rule or mechanic is to role-playing games relative to just, like, rolling dice and skill checks and all that kind of garbage, right?
Yeah, like, I kind of feel like the term that I kind of feel like, I don't love the diegetic versus hypodiegetic kind of academic terms particularly, because I feel they kind of obfuscate what it's doing for us. And really what this is kind of like, it's good world building, it's kind of very fruitful world building or fruitful fiction for our role-playing games that have lots of implications for how we play in a way that our actual kind of dice rolling mechanics and things like that have lots of implications for how we play.
Absolutely. So I want to start with just the conversation of like, why am I calling this a mechanic? Because like when I started Dice Exploder, right away, I was having this conversation being like, everything's a mechanic. You know, it's still a meme in the Dice Exploder Discord to say cover art is a mechanic, right? And I really liked this framing because it opened up a conversation that I felt like wasn't being had enough. And I still think in a lot of ways isn't being had enough, which is like, to get into the like system matters versus system doesn't matter debate, right? It's like the thing that felt important to me about that conversation was everything matters to your game. Like which dice you are rolling does matter, but also like what does the art look like on the cover changes people's perceptions as they are sitting down at the table to play the game. And like those vibes are then going to get incorporated into their role playing. And all of that matters when you sit down to play a game.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it. So like, yeah, system does matter, but it is one ingredient in like a pretty complex recipe that includes your fiction, the style of your writing, your art, your layout, your cover, all of these other things that are probably equal contributors to like what matters as the system or the kind of various particular, the way you roll the dice and the kind of the thing that you do when this happens.
Yeah. But I recognize, I think you maybe feel this way from having had conversations with you, that like when I say that, when I say cover art is also a mechanic, I'm like doing a flattening, right? Like I am saying everything is system, and that makes it then harder to have the conversation that like we want to have today about like, okay, cool, but let's talk about the ways in which the fiction that you are coming to the table with does matter.
Yes. Yeah, I do think it flattens things out. And that is useful for some purposes. It's useful to kind of draw attention to things that aren't, this is a 2D6 system. Like, you think of the way that Powered by the Apocalypse games kind of entered into the common vernacular are effectively, this is a 2D6 game, in the same way that back in the 2000s, D20 games became a thing. And like, if you read anything by Vincent or McGay, they don't feel like the 2D6 is really an important or core part of what made Apocalypse World tick. So like, in it, that flattening is helpful for the purpose of drawing attention to a lot of things, but also it takes a very different skill to kind of think about the probabilities involved in implementing, you know, a Powered by the Apocalypse dice mechanic into your game.
Sure.
Then it takes to put together, like, to art design a product, or to design a meaningful fiction or whatever.
Yeah. Like, I would argue that rolling 2d6 instead of d20 has overall had a not big impact on the way people play games. Like, if Apocalypse World used a D20, like, the game would look a little different, but also, like, the conversations around design would be pretty similar right now. Whereas the two words psychic maelstrom fucking blew things up, you know?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And just, like, the potential in that fiction makes a huge difference. And, like, I know for me, was the first game that I read after primarily being in traditional games. Like, I picked up Apocalypse World in the year after it was released, and things like the Psychic Maelstrom blew my mind. Things like moves blew my mind. That was stuff that was completely different in terms of the fiction inviting you to expand on the world and providing some hard barriers and some invitations that I'd never seen before.
Yeah, so let's get into the details here with, like, lightning barriers specifically, and what, like, this piece of fiction is doing for your table when you sit down to play Blades in the Dark. The first thing that it does is it's just, like, fucking cool, right? Like, I feel like we kind of covered this in the introduction, but, like, when I give you the pitch, yeah, it's a haunted city infested with ghosts with a lightning fence to keep them all out that's powered by demon blood, you're just like, yeah, that fucking rules. Let's do that.
Yeah.
But then a step down from that, like, the big reason this exists, I think, and is that, like, Duskfall as a city is designed to be a city to do crime in, right? Like, in the same way that, like, it's always nighttime because the sun has been exploded. That exists because, like, you can do crimes at night more, right? And that's fun. And in the same way, like, the lightning barriers exist to keep you in the city, to make it so you can't just go run away from your crimes and, like, pop over to the next city over, or pop out into the, like, some farmhouse and, like, lay low. You have to sit with the consequences of what you're doing, or you have to go outside and get eaten by ghosts, right? Like, that's what the lightning barriers are for, fundamentally.
Yes. So it basically turns the city of Duskfall into a pressure cooker. And so in a lot of ways, very easy to look at Blades in the Dark as a game about crime and about doing heists. And that's a reasonable take on the game, but I think that actually it's more of a game about being trapped with the consequences of your actions. It's about the butterfly effect of your actions and how that happens when you're in a small echo chamber you can't step outside of. I do think that the fact that it's kind of misanalyzed, in my opinion, or at least the emphasis lands on it's a heist game, underestimates how much of it is about that kind of trapped in a toxic space. And you look at, like, a lot of the mechanics that surround the basic mechanic there, they're all about your harm, how you're suffering, what the consequences of actions, who you're angering, who you've pissed off.
Going to jail, heat.
Exactly, right? So like, all of those things are about the consequences of your actions and interpreting how they impact you. So I feel like Blades in the Dark is more about that than the heist. The heists are just the catalyst. And, like, to be clear, it's really fun.
And they're the pitch, right? Like, this is why people talk about them, is because, like, you don't tell people, like, you want to come in and live with the consequences of your actions, kid?
Yes, exactly.
But yeah, so like the lightning barrier exists in support of all of that, I think, like, and also because it's fucking cool.
And that's why we kind of want to talk about it as like a mechanic, right? Because I cannot think of a better way to handle this setup.
Yeah.
Doing it in a more traditionally mechanical way, right? Like I think that the best solution in a role-playing game context is using the fiction to do this, is the lightning barrier or something similar. And that's why kind of like is a mechanic, I'm, you know, doing air quotes here, because there's no other way to do this. And so sometimes in your game design, you're going to be faced with challenges where your solution must be fiction.
Yeah. I have actually an example here from a game that I'm kickstarting later this year. I'm making this game called Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. It's like a John Wick simulator. And the way I had the game set up was like, someone decides they're John Wick now, and they like come into a bar and they say who in the bar they want something from. And then someone else picks up John Wick's target. And so now you're playing as the bartender and I'm playing as John Wick. And I come to you and I'm like, who killed my dog? Give me their address. And like all that is working great. That's barely rules, right? People just kind of intuitively get that when you tell them they're doing John Wick, but you can like formalize the procedures for like setting up that thing. And the problem I was running into was then Nova, who has picked up the bartender, sort of intuitively understands, well, I can't just give John Wick the address because that's not how these movies work, right? Like I have to be like, well, no, you have to beat it out of me. You have to ask me for something in return. And so I tried so many ways to like make people do this, right? Like I tried saying like, hey, the rule is you must ask for something in return. That's the mechanic. And people wanted to follow the rule, but just didn't know how to. They couldn't figure out like, what am I supposed to offer in return? It's just, you need a certain level of improv skill in order to come up with something. Finally, what I did was I was like, okay, it's John Wick. There's some sort of like mysterious council that like sets all the like laws of the Assassin's Guild and so forth. So one of those laws is just no helping each other kill each other. So now when I show up as John Wick and I'm like, who killed my dog and what is their address? You're like, well, I can't help you because then the council will come kick my ass. And then I'm like, well, I'll kick your ass right now. And we've got a fucking scene going. By creating the law in the fiction, you completely solve the problem.
If there's some necessary kind of improvisation fodder that you need as a player, as a referee, whatever, to kind of springboard off. And kind of what you're talking about there is that by making this rule a fictional construct, you're giving people something to springboard off because we're expected to improvise the fiction in role-playing games largely. We're not as expected to improvise mechanical things. And so there you're setting an in-game rule, like a hypodiegetic rule, to use the terms we were using before, to use that springboard. And like Duskvol in general, including the Lightning Barrier, if you haven't read the Blades in the Dark book, is, I would say, 1/3, like 30% the rules. And the other 60% of the book is tables of things you might encounter, events. There's a huge percentage of this book that is just lists of factions and the things they want and the people in them. There are lists of locations, there are institutions and how they interact with each other. Most of Blades in the Dark, and I think what makes it unique and special, is actually all of those narrative beats. The same guy who wrote about, who kind of, I think, coined the words hypodiegetic, Sam Sorensen, also wrote about this as something called legwork. Most of Blades in the Dark as a book is Duskvol legwork. And that legwork is that improvisational fodder that you can springboard off to take the next step and to ensure what the impact of your actions will be or how this person will respond to you. And it's a really excellent model, in my opinion, for how to build legwork in a way that is really impactful for play.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to like check in on the In Praise of Legwork is Sam Sorensen's like original piece on this. And I find what you're saying especially interesting because my recollection of that piece is that he shits on Blades in the Dark in it for not doing enough legwork. That like a lot of the same people who are like really loving legwork and like most championing legwork are also like, what are you doing with this fucking like flashback stuff in Blades in the Dark? What are you doing with this ability to like, oh, we know the lightning barriers exist, but like okay, how do they work exactly? Like, they want all that legwork, like, dialed all the way down, where I find Blades to be at this, like, really perfect spot for me personally of, like, having done all this legwork that I can then riff on, but then I can pick up that stuff and fill in the gaps. You know, I can really, like, run with it on my own, or, like, turn over to the table. Okay, we're, like, facing down a lightning barrier and you're trying to blow it up. How do you think it works? Like, what do we want to do with it here, you know? There's clearly a matter of taste in, like, how much legwork is the right amount of legwork to bring to the table.
I think there's also a matter of taste or preference in terms of what legwork means. And I think that is to do with how you improvise a scene. So I think the example that Sam focuses on in that article in praise of legwork is City State of the Invincible Overlord, which is, I believe, is a Judges Guild module from the 80s. And a lot of the legwork there is stat blocks for every character, treasure in every room, where all the traps are. Those are the things. And a lot of that legwork that Sam refers to in the original article and praises is mechanical legwork, which I haven't played with Sam, but that gives me the strong impression that he wants to go from scratch with every character and invent their goals and their relationships, but he doesn't want to have to wing the mechanics ever. Whereas from my perspective, I prefer the legwork in Duskfall because I do not have much trouble winging the mechanics, right? Like, even like if we're playing Blades in the Dark proper, I think the system is really well set up for me to be able to improvise basically any action that would be governed by the mechanics.
NPCs don't even have stats in Blades in the Dark, right?
Yes, precisely. And I'm familiar enough with D&D alikes that, you know, I can improvise hit dice and AC and all those kind of things. And so I don't feel I need the support there, but I do have more trouble off the cuff coming up with a set of relationships that feels meaningful or is deeper. And that's what I want out of my legwork. And I think that is a divergence in kind of preference for what you like improvising and what you find intuitive to improvise. That is probably something that is worth acknowledging and recognizing that you really have to decide. Well, I suppose you could design for both audiences. That would be a lot of work. But like, you probably need to think about what your audience is. Who's going to be refereeing this? Who's going to be playing this when it comes to what kind of legwork you want to do?
Yeah, I want to take that thought. And I want to come back to the, like, purposes of lightning barriers we were talking about earlier. We kind of got this, like, twofold purpose. And one is the, like, almost mechanical purpose of, like, keeping people in Duskfall. I think that's really interesting. I think, like, a lesson you can take as a designer from this episode and from Blades in the Dark is, like, fictional solutions to problems probably go over really well. But the other, I want to spend more time talking about the other purpose of just, like, being really fucking cool. When I'm sitting down to play a game, this is, like, especially true with modules, right? For adventure modules or any kind of this fiction in any kind of game, not just in sort of traditional, like, OSR, NSR style modules, but even in story games, like, what I'm really looking for when I sit down to the table to play is cool as shit ideas I would not have been able to come up with on my own at home, or that would have taken me forever to come up with on my own, right? Some sort of cool thing to start from that I can riff on, whether that's in prep or at the table. And, like, so Duskfall is, like, full of this shit, right? But, like, Psychic Maelstrom, those two words are, like, a classic example of this, right? And I was talking in my interview with the Bakers about Apocalypse World 3rd edition, how much I really love Hard Zones, this new addition that they've had to the game, where they're basically, like, this hard zone is the frozen tundra, so we know it's, like, a frozen wastes, and there's, like, 10 locations that are each just one sentence long of, like, Sword Town, like, an abandoned mining town, like, above, like, mines that who know what. Like,
yeah, the little kind of legwork capsules in a way.
Totally, exactly. And the other big example of this, I think, that has really gotten into people's heads recently is Mythic Bastion Land, which is just entirely this shit. 72 myths that you could encounter in this Arthurian world, or 72 knights or sages that you might, like, run across. Another great example, I think, is Wanderhome. Wanderhome is just almost entirely, like, lists of locations and character traits that you might pull from when you sit down to play. And all of these examples that I'm giving also are games that contain rules and unique rules that are really like situated to highlight their particular games. Like the system associated with these, the rules system does matter to the play of these games. But I really want to just underline how much weight hard zones and myths and lightning barriers are doing when you sit down at the table.
Yeah, I think that like people who know me know that I have a deep interest in kind of D&D, like so the OSR. So for me, I naturally have an inclination to just adoring games where so much weight is put on the diegetic and I guess hypodiegetic components, like Mythic Bastion Land. And I think Mythic Bastion Land is a really great example of, I don't think Mythic Bastion Land is an OSR game. I think that obviously it has roots there. Chris McDowell authored this game. It's based on Into the Odd, which is very explicitly based on kind of zero edition of D&D. However, I don't think it is. It just has that inspiration, that kind of broader narrative world inspiration where that kind of is the focus and the rules chunk, like I guess technically the first 25 pages, but if I look at the 10 pages, the last 10 page, 20 pages, I would say realistically.
Yeah. So, and there's more examples of play at the back and stuff to help explain the rules further. But like so much of the book is the kind of stuff that we're talking
correct,
about here.
Right.
Hey, you! You don't look familiar. First time in this part of the city? I see that sneer on your face. Better wipe it off before I do it for you. This is home. This is the best place you could ever want to be. Whether or not this is where you meant to end up, you found yourself on a rather fortuitous street. You see that corner building down there? 3 floors up. Lamplight Investigative Services. Friends of mine, you ask. Loaded words you're throwing around this evening. Good people is what they are, though. Not a single one of them will admit to being nice. Something about duty, yada yada. A bunch of BS, if I do say so myself. Who am I? No need to worry your pretty little head about that. I'm sure my name will come up in time. But go, see for yourself, 3 floors up, gold-gilded sign. As for Mama, don't tell him I sent you. She'll know what to do.
All doors are just windows that we can't see through. You ever think about that?
We provide our patrons with anonymity.
Hello, this is Mama Amoretta speaking.
Lamplight Investigations, a Thirsty Sword Lesbian's noir mystery. Full season available now on QueerPG.
And that's why I have such a deep interest in modules, because from my perspective, that is here, has some narrative, you know, relatively divorced from the context of the mechanics. What does this mean as kind of a game design thesis?
Yeah, that's making me think about another kind of component of this that I think you especially saw when John released Deep Cuts for Blades in the Dark. Of the lightning barriers are not particularly like modular to Blades in the Dark, although you're seeing now in Blade 68, Tim has brought in something else, a big bubble to kind of like serve the same purpose but feel different. But like in Wanderhome, in Mythic Bastion Land, even in Blades with its like huge lists of factions and so forth, and its districts, like even if the districts are always there, you're given a lot of options for what to do with your home table, right? There's a lot of different fiction you can plug in or unplug from the game. If you don't want the spirit wardens to be a big presence in your version of Duskfall because you just find them boring, you can just have them not around, you know? Or like there are many other factions that don't feel as essential to the running of the city that like might just not exist in your game because like who fucking cares, you know? But I think that is a really healthy approach to how to think about the fiction, that like Mythic Bastion Land, Wander Home, Blades in the Dark, all of these games that are bringing huge swaths of modular fiction to the table, you can plug and play with. But that's also true. I brought up Deep Cuts because that's so obviously also true with mechanics in Blades in the Dark. John
published this whole book of like, hey, here's a different way to do the action roll. And like, if I came in and I wanted to run Blades in the Dark with a D20 instead of a dice pool, like the game would feel different. System does matter, right? But also like, that's modular. I could swap that in or out and still have something that felt very Blades because I was still using heat and lightning barriers and all this other stuff.
Yeah, I think that is probably the important thing. Like, this would still be Blades if I subbed in 5e as kind of a mechanical system with dice rolls on a d20, etc. However, I don't think it would be Blades without the lightning barrier. I don't think it would be Blades without heat and turf and things like that. And so I think that, like, when it comes to hacking Blades, like, there are, you know, a lot of quite prominent Blades in the Dark hacks, Scum and Villainy, Band of Blades, Beam Saber. I think that the bits of Blades that are essential to Blades aren't the procedure of, like, downtime, and they aren't the dice pool mechanic. They're actually the heat and the turf and the lightning barrier and all the legwork. And so, like, I think there are some mechanics that if you remove them from Blades, it would no longer be the game.
I think turf is a particularly interesting one to look at. Maybe I should even do a whole episode on this, but, like, that one's interesting because it is so strongly mechanical and fictional simultaneously. Like, the lightning barriers, there's not a rule about the lightning barriers. And position and effect, there's not, like, a fictional rules for orchestrating your conversation about the fiction, but it's very abstract. Whereas, like, turf is grid on your character sheet, right, that you can move from thing to thing. And also, when you move from thing to thing, that means something in the fiction at the same time, right?
Yeah.
Now I
your
own...
grid is the map of Duskfall.
Yeah, or at least your turf, right? Like, it's your thing. And the thing I was going to say about turf is, if you pulled out just the mechanical portion of it, I think you would maybe still have Blades, right? Like, I have never played with the, like my groups, when I play Blades in the Dark, have essentially ignored the turf map, even as they are going around and collecting turf fictionally.
Yes. I think that turf is a visual expression on the character sheet. It's not on the character sheet, right? It's actually on the crew sheet.
Yeah.
I'd have to double check that. But I think that, you know what, in none of my planning for this episode did I consider talking about the crew sheet as part of this, but that is also a very fascinating and unique part of Blades.
Yeah.
I think that in terms of Blades, and the lightning barrier is very relevant to this, Blades is actually a very visuospatial, I don't know if that's the right word. It takes place in a concrete world where spatial relationships matter.
Yeah.
Who you're next to matters.
It's a crowded city, and, like, that's really important to the feeling, because that gets back to the, like, whole conversation about consequences we were talking about earlier.
Exactly. And so that's why turf is important. That's why you can essentially play it without using that turf map, because you get a good sense. When I play Blades in the Dark, I play with Tyndanese Duskfall maps, which are effectively a street-by-street, block-by-block mapping of the entire of Duskfall. You can get, like, a huge map that you can lay on the table. When I used these, I played online, and they were, like, the main screen everyone was looking at. You can be like, I'm on the corner of this street and that street. And I felt, and my players felt, that that really enhanced the experience, because you are kind of thinking on the level of block by block, really, when you're thinking about turf. And I think that's probably something that is also understated about Blades, is how important the space of Duskfall is. In the same way that in a dungeon crawl, the rooms are important, in Duskfall, the blocks and the districts and their relationship to each other is really important.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've never run Blades with those maps from Tim, but I have always had the instinct that I would not like them, because I feel like the benefit that you would get from using those maps, and correct me if I'm wrong, is partly, you know, okay, I'm looking at this and I see that the place we're trying to rob is right next to, like, a meatpacking plant. Okay, cool. Maybe we can use the meatpacking plant as part of the robbery. And, like, that's cool as we're, like, negotiating what the fiction of this heist is going to look like. Whereas When you don't have the maps, then you leave that space open and you can like make it up and fill it in on the fly, right? Like suddenly it's like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if a meatpacking plant was next to this place so we could do XYZ? But also, wouldn't it be cool if an orphanage was next to the place? Like you can kind of like do that negotiation. And again, I think that's comes back to the matter of taste, right? At what scale do you want your legwork to be existing at?
Exactly. And for me, it's just like it's more just an expression of those relationships that already exist in the text. And so that helps people kind of remember and reference them in a way that having the book on your table, like next to you on the table, doesn't do so much.
Yeah. And the equivalent for me when I was playing it was just putting the more zoomed out full map of the city on the table that everyone is looking at, right? And then suddenly it's like, yeah, okay, cool. We can see we're in this district and the next district over is what we're butting up against more than the next block over. And you can just, this is the thing about all this like modular fiction is it's like great to have all of this legwork so you can decide for your table and taste what to use. And like, that's what makes Blade so fucking magical is it's got it all.
No, 100%. Can I tell like a story about when I ran the two times I've run Blades? I've run two campaigns. The first campaign, it was the first time I'd run Blades. I'd had it in my library for years at that point and hadn't had an opportunity. It was also during the pandemic. I was playing online and I got so into the fiction. I had clocks for almost all of the factions. I just went overboard on this campaign. Super high prep. And a lot of that was like entirely me and entirely the space I was, you know, at that time, at that a lot of us were in at that time. But the second time I ran Blades, I just picked up the book. I just picked up the book and I ran it and they went, I still had the maps printed out on the table. This was in person. And I just ticked off, I started off clocks when they encountered something. I'd be like, oh yeah, that's probably a good place to introduce the spirit wardens or whatever. And then I would go and add them in, right? And that worked extremely well as well. This game is designed such that puts me in mind of the baker's powered by the apocalypse onion that you can peel back layers on. So just to recap that, basically Vincent Baker in a series of essays around powered by apocalypse games talks about how Apocalypse World is designed such that you can play with all of the rules, but they are designed such that if you can't handle all of them, you can remove one layer and then another layer and then another layer.
His term is that the game degrades gracefully.
Yes, precisely. And I think that in a similar way, Blades in the Dark can degrade gracefully to kind of accommodate people who want to spend a lot of time really thinking about and developing their prep out. But also, it holds together really well if you're just picking out the book and completely winging it. And I think that's that part of that is because of that modular nature of all of this fiction.
Well, that also gets into a big part of my experience with running Blades a bunch of times was something I recognized in your story of like gradually developing my own canon for me running Blades, right? Like the first time I sat down to run Blades, I did like all this prep of like I read the book like several times. I'm trying to internalize everything that's going on there. I'm like highlighting which pieces am I going to be really excited to bring to the table. I'm like, what are my players bringing to the table? You know, you get all set up and like, I'm nervous, you know, and then at the first six sessions of play or whatever, I'm like getting used to it and remembering things and some things are falling away. I tried this out. I don't care about it anymore. Or like the book says that everyone eats eels and mushrooms, but actually it's like important that we're eating potatoes in this scene for some stupid reason. So like now there's potatoes in my Dusk Ball and shit like that. And like, then the next time I run Blades, like a second campaign, I just bring over all the shit that I decided last time. It's way easier, you know? Like, I'm bringing over the NPCs I decided last time. I'm bringing over the player characters as NPCs. Like, I'm drawing on this deep well of canon that I have built on top of Blades. And that really, I think, mirrors the experience of mechanically, like, tailoring the game to my taste and my table's taste, too, right? Like, when we discover, oh, yeah, we don't actually, like, turf makes more sense to us as a purely fictional concept rather than a mechanical concept, I'm also like bringing my sense of just kind of like hand waving or handling fictionally how to do turf to the next table. And I think people are doing that all the time in every game that they play. Like Dungeons and Dragons is like built on this. Everyone's house ruling it. This is why people are house ruling stuff, is to like tailor everything to your taste. Like if the game itself is a toolbox, you're figuring out like which of those tools matter to you and like bringing that forward to the next thing that you're doing. And I think that's all a cool process. That's a great process. That's a process that as a designer, at least as a designer of long-term campaign games, you should be designing for people to do with your game. And like, you should be doing that with the fiction as much as you are doing it with the mechanics. That's the thing I keep underlining in this episode, is how much I love taking that legwork and then building on it, like building my own shit on top of it.
Yes. And I think that that's actually a really interesting, I don't know if it's an intentional impact of these narrative seeds that John Harper plants in Blades in the Dark, but you get this interesting phenomenon where, because every Duskfall has a Lord Skurlock, but Lord Skurlock gets like 3 mentions, I think, in the book, right? He's not a major character, but he is, spoilers for a 10-year-old game, like he is like a vampire that appears to like potentially, you know, run some kind of Illuminati in the city, is that different campaigns and different tables have different Skurlocks. And have different, all of these characters, because, you know, some of the allies in your, on your character sheets will show up in other people's campaigns as slightly different characters. And there's this really interesting community experience there where you have these characters in common. And that's really like, and you know, we all have lightning barriers. We all have Leviathans and that communal experience of these characters. Because Blades is so kind of locked down and tight, becomes really like something to rally around as a community in a really fun way.
Yeah, it's something I've been talking with my friend Lynn Cadega a bunch about this recently, of like how Over Under was really successful because it was like a self-creating fandom, right? Like it was a fiction. The fiction itself was the fan fiction, kind of like it was like this thing that created a fandom around it because it had all those like knobs that like a fandom wants to attach onto. And I think that's like a really compelling way of thinking about the exact dynamic you were talking about. And like what this kind of, I mean, even something just like the list of names in Apocalypse World. Every Apocalypse World is really different, but like a lot of Apocalypse Worlds have a Grome, you know, and that Grome is going to be a different guy, but like there's still a vibe that like they all have like this fingerprint from the designer on them in a kind of a shared way that's really fun. So we've been going for a while. To kind of like wrap us up here, I want to, I mean, I just said this seconds ago, but like my thesis here, the underlining that I wanted to do here was like, you should do this kind of shit in your home game, right? Like you should give me like a bunch of like cool fiction that I can like take up and pick up and run with and like build my own fan, like be a fan of, like build my own canon on top of. And that the last thing I kind of want to underline with that is like, that can look really different and does look really different in different games, right? Like to use the Mythic Bastion Land example, the myths feel so different from the faction list in Blades in the Dark, even though they're serving this kind of similar purpose that we've been talking about, right? Like the myths in Mythic Bastion Land, like, are they real? Like, is that true? Like they feel more like rumors, you know, they don't necessarily feel locked in. And they are so brief. There's so little to them. There's so much space to kind of fill in whatever you're going to do with them. And in Blades, like, there is still space to do that. We talked about that with the maps, right? Like, we talked about the plug-and-play ability, or like, even just one faction description is going to have, like, here are 3 NPCs and, like, 2 words about each of them. You know, there's plenty of space there to flesh out who those people are. But Blades still feels locked in, like dialed in a way that Mythic Bastion Land feels open-ended over at a big picture to me. And so there, I just want to emphasize there's a lot of different ways to do this thing.
And I think that that's kind of, this is one way that like, I don't feel like anyone spends enough time thinking about how your kind of mechanical choices and your narrative choices reflect the themes in your game. You know, we're talking about how Duskfall is kind of about being stuck in a toxic environment. Mythic Bastionland is not about being stuck. It's about venturing out and exploring. And so the fact that it is that the myths, which are kind of like the kind of core unit of play, consist of like a line of poetry. I think it's 1d6 omens, two or three characters, and like a random table with like 6 to 12 items on it that kind of varies depending on the nature of the myth. And the fact that they're kind of vague and open-ended lends itself to the myth part of the myth. It's supposed to be vague. It's supposed to be up for interpretation. It's supposed to be kind of fairy tale-like and follow fairy tale logic, as in the same way that Duskfall is supposed to feel like you're trapped with people that don't necessarily have it in for you, but certainly care more about their own survival than about anyone else's.
It makes me think about, I'm a screenwriter now, and one of the big pieces of writing advice that I've been internalizing over the past couple of years has been like just asking the question, what do you want people to feel when they walk out of the movie? And like, how do you write to that feeling? And I don't think thinking about the end of the experience is necessarily the right thing to do with game design, but that question of like, what do you want people to feel while they're playing your game during the experience of playing it feels so helpful and so essential. And you should think about that. And then you should put it in the fiction of your world, not just in the rules that you use to get there.
Yeah, precisely. And like, I'm sure that there are many, many examples of this kind of fruitful fiction, this kind of diegetic or hypodiegetic rules, as you could call them. But like, you can also kind of, I think you're going to have an entire episode on Triangle Agency soon. However, like Triangle Agency is like a really great example of pushing this concept to the absolute limit, where the entire book is hypodiegetic. They're in-world rules. And in many ways, the entire rule set expects you to break those rules.
Yeah.
And so kind of like, yeah, you can kind of like, I think the important thing here is looking at our themes and how this narrative, this fiction that we're putting in place reflects the themes of being a knight in an Arthurian myth or being a criminal with no prospects, desperate to their head above water, or, you know, you are trapped in a corporate monstrosity and you have to show up day to day, even though you hate your job. The fiction is often a really important way of expressing those themes as much as the mechanics are.
We could leave it there, but I want to do one last example. In Wanderhome, like the feeling of exploration in that game so much comes from the way that you are taking these discrete pieces of diegesis, like the different kinds of locations, and smashing them together into something that feels like discovery. In Blades, there's always like the crows or the gang next door, whereas in Wanderhome, you're taking a university and a hamlet and you're smashing them together and being like, what's a university hamlet? Let's discover it. And that's the feeling that game wants you to have, right? That's it. We did it. I mean, that's the episode, though. Nova, thanks so much for being back on Dice Explorer.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Thanks again to Nova for being here. You can read more of her on her blog, Playful Void, and you can follow her on Blue Sky at Idle Cartoolery. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky at Dice Exploder, and you can find my games at sdonewald.itch.io. My game, Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, is coming to Kickstarter this May. Go follow that project there now. There's a link in the show notes for that, too. Our logo was designed by Spore Garee. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray, and our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy, Travis Tesmer. This episode was edited by M. Acosta. M's the best. Thank you, M. And thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time.